Yes, it's that time of the week where we talk to our pet chat team, but we have one today, Dr. Kimberly Earle. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Now, you want to talk about summer safety for pets. What does that entail?
Well, you know, monitoring for heat stress, what to do in the case of heat stress. Some, if we get a chance, some of the dangers you might encounter at the beach, those sorts of things. It's a hot day today, so it's a good time to talk about it.
And we've got Christine from Morisset on the line. Hi, Christine. How can we help you?
Well, my adult granddaughter has been given a little kitten, and I swear it's under 6 weeks old.
Mm-hmm.
It's got diarrhea.
Okay. This is persistent diarrhea, not just a single sort of bout? Yep.
It's not completely liquid now. It's getting soft, but the bloke that gave it to her, he was feeding it adult food.
Okay.
And I said, no, it needs kitten food.
Yeah.
Because she got that, and she reckons she saw something where she boiled some chicken with some pumpkin and rice.
Yep.
Can that help?
It can help. So the first thing, a little six-week-old kitten, there's lots of things that they're very susceptible to. So we want to make sure that the kitten has been wormed with an appropriate intestinal all-wormer. Certainly having it on kitten food is good. Adult food shouldn't cause diarrhea, but any change in food from whatever the original owner or breeder was feeding it to what your granddaughter's feeding it could cause a bit of stomach upset. But that would usually last, you know, only a few days. So hopefully, only a few days. Mm-hmm. We do, you know, you can use things like pumpkin and cooked chicken and a bit of rice. We do that mostly for dogs, though, particularly the rice. Cats aren't big on rice. But I just always worry because there are lots of pathogens in a really young kitten like that that could cause problems. So it's definitely worthwhile having her up to your local veterinary hospital. Take a sample of the stool, if you can, in a Ziploc baggie or something like that, so that they can have a look at it. There's lots of intestinal wormers on the market. You can definitely pick that up anywhere at any, you know, good quality pet shop or over the counter at most vet hospitals.
She bought it off the internet. I'm going to worm it.
It needs to be done pretty quick because we want to be worming her every fortnight, really. And then the important thing is the kitten otherwise bright? Is it eating? Is it having any vomiting? Is it running around and doing all the things that kittens should do? So that's good. Male. That's the really important thing.
They're mock fighting, I reckon. She's only had it a week or so, but she got it and it had diarrhea. That's what I say. But, they're chasing each other around.
Sure, good. So, definitely, if it persists, we definitely want to get it looked at because it may be that there's actually something in there that's not an intestinal worm. There's other pathogens that they can have that might need a specific treatment. So, and at any point, if the kitten becomes quiet or lethargic or goes off of its food, that would become an emergency. It needs a same-day vet visit, okay?
Yeah. Thanks very much for that.
You're very welcome, Christine. Take care.
Bye. Thanks very much. And we're going to talk about summer safety tips for pets.
Yeah, so it's a pretty hot day today. And I thought we should just talk about summer safety and heat stress, identifying heat stress in pets, some of those things. So heat stress is one of the most common presentations that we see throughout the summer seasons. And it particularly on really hot days like today, but also on days when we have really high humidity, because dogs in particular need to get rid of extra heat through panting. But panting is a much less effective way of cooling yourself if the air is already really moist. So even on the days where it might only be a moderate temperature, but if the humidity is high and your dog's been out exercising, they actually can get into a lot of trouble because they're unable to cool themselves off. So what does heat stress look like? So usually in the early stages, we'll see panting, and it might be panting where the dog hasn't actually done very much exercise or they've done a little bit of exercise, but they haven't been able to catch their breath in a normal amount of time afterwards. So, you know, you went out for a 20-minute walk and then the dog's been at home and it's been half an hour and they're still panting as if they were just out, you know, at the park or whatever. So panting, sometimes we'll see these dogs, their tongue starts to extrude a lot. I mean, lots of dogs have a big, long tongue, but they're really sort of pushing it out there and it's big and it's really red or pink looking. Sometimes their gums are really red or pink and they're sort of slobbering, almost frothing at the mouth. And that, again, because they're trying to cool themselves through that that generation of saliva and the panting. Their heartbeat might be really, really fast. And some dogs will actually start to show a lot of anxiety or restlessness, like they just can't, you know, settle down. And you'd think that they might go and seek water. But by that point, sometimes they will. But by that point, some of them, they can't catch their breath enough to actually safely swallow. And so they might go and stand over at the water, but then not actually drink because they actually don't think that they can stop breathing for long enough to safely swallow.
Oh, wow.
So that can be problematic for them. And then in the later stages, we will start to get really noisy breathing. So all of a sudden your dog, if they start to breathe like they're a little bit obstructed or like they've got something in their throat, it can be a really noisy, almost like a barking, you know, sort of breathing. And then they can collapse. And obviously at that point, they're in real trouble. So we want to think about cooling the dog down, but we don't want to get them, you know, we don't want to put ice packs on them. Water is a really helpful way. So cool water, and we need air movement on these guys. So we need to have a fan. If you can, get them into the air conditioning. If they're in a bad way, get them into your air conditioned car and get them into a vet. It's not recommended to put wet towels on them because the towels actually trap the heat in. So even though the towels are wet, they'll actually hold the body heat in. So you can lay them on a towel, on a wet towel, but we don't want anything over top of them. And airflow is the real key, getting a fan. So when we have a heat stress dog come into hospital, we obviously get an IV catheter in because running IV fluids into them helps to cool them down. And helps to replace the fluid losses that they're losing from the panting. We will wet their feet down, depending on how badly they're affected. Sometimes they get things like cool water enemas once they're anesthetized. We often have to guard their airways by putting them under an anesthetic and putting a breathing tube down. And then we start running fans on them. So we get them damp and we run fans on them, running water over their feet, because that's really the only areas that dogs can sweat is from their feet. So, you know, running a garden hose over their feet and if they'll tolerate it, and obviously offering lots of, you know, sips of cool water if they're still conscious. But we definitely don't recommend syringing them water or putting running water into their mouth if they're not well enough to be, you know, holding their head up and things like that. So we don't want to do anything like that. And it is really a thing that we have to worry about, particularly with our brachycephalic dogs. So these are our squashy face dogs, right? Pugs, French bulldogs, other bulldogs, staffies even, boxers, Cavalier King Charles Spaniels. Those dogs have the same amount of what we call nasal turbinate bone. So all the little fine channels and bones in the nose, they have the same amount of that, but it's squished into a really, really small area. And what that does is it actually means that the airflow through their nasal passages and their respiratory passages where they're trying to cool themselves, the airflow is really restricted. And if you think about, air that's slowly meandering up and down a winding corridor versus an air, you know, a wind tunnel where you get a nice cooling breeze, that's what's happening in these guys. And so they're way more prone to having heat stroke. But we also need to think about the dogs who have really thick coats. So huskies, even some Labradors have a really thick coat. Anything that's got like a double undercoat. Those dogs are also very prone to heat stress. And even coat color makes a big difference. So if you have a blonde colored dog, a golden retriever, who's like my dog, likes to sit in the sun, they're at lower risk of heat stroke than, say, a black lab or a Doberman or a dark staffy, you know, dark brindle staffy, because the dark coat color actually will attract the heat. And then we have to think about our little dogs who, or not little dogs, any dogs who have heart disease or lung disease. So if they're not breathing well, if you've got a collapsing trachea dog, those dogs can't cool themselves as well. If your dog has heart disease, they're not going to be able to tolerate it as well. So we need to protect them. Shade, lots of cool water. Don't take your dogs out for a walk, on a hot day like this, even if it's early in the day, but it's a really hot day. We need to think about heat stress as being a real, you know, and it's life-threatening. And sometimes we get their body temperature down, but they've already done damage to the organs that might not make itself apparent for 36 to 48 hours. And so it can be really, really sad because we get them back into a normal body temperature range, But 2 days later, they crash and burn again, and they're in end-stage kidney or liver disease, and there's nothing we can do about it at that point. So it's a really tricky disease to treat if they've had a bad bout of it. So
what about cats and maybe rabbits or chickens, things like that that might be outdoors sometimes?
Sure. So cats do tend to be a little bit more sensible about heat-seeking, and because people aren't taking them out on walks as often, they're a little bit more protected, but we absolutely can see heat stress in cats, and mostly we're going to see cats who are panting, who fail to sort of relax. So those cats, they're often walking around panting, or they're sitting there and they're just not moving, often with their elbows out away from the body. They're trying to sort of keep the channels of airflow open through the body, and their mouth is open. They might be panting, they might be refusing water, sometimes they're vocalizing. We do see cats occasionally collapsed from heat stress, and this will often happen, you know, if a cat sneaks into a car or sneaks into a garden shed or a greenhouse and they accidentally get trapped in there, and that's when, you know, big problems can happen. Rabbits and guinea pigs, super, super prone to heat stress. These little guys do not, they're these little round bodies that are very dense for the size of them, and they don't have big lungs. They have little lungs compared to the size of their body. They also don't pant very well, like it's not something that we see. Rabbits can cool from their ears a little bit, but again, they need to be able to like get some airflow and things like that. So they are really, really prone to heat stress, and we would always recommend if you've got outdoor rabbits or guinea pigs on a hot day, please try to move them inside. Certainly, as a minimum, we need to get them into the shade. And a lot of people will give rabbits and guinea pigs frozen water bottles. So old soft drink bottles that they stick in the freezer. And you'll see these guys will actually lie right up against them or sometimes on top of them. That can be really beneficial. Chickens and birds do tend to have a bit of a higher tolerance for high heat. Their normal body temperatures are sitting at about 41 degrees as opposed to, you know, our body temperature, our dog's body temperature, which is sort of closer to 38 degrees. So they do have a higher tolerance. And they've got the benefit that they can actually flap their wings a little bit and they can create a bit of air movement. But we do see hot animals, hot birds, particularly if they're a little bit sick, they're not very good. And we would always tell people to make sure we're not doing anything like medicating animals, particularly birds, with medications in water on really hot days. So a lot of wormers for chickens or wormers for sort of Cajun aviary birds, you put them into the water and they make the water taste a bit funny. And the birds on a really hot day, we don't want anything to deter them from being able to take in a normal amount of, you know, body water. I've had it happen numerous times over my career that people will sort of say, oh, I had this die off of budgies, you know, on the weekend. It was really hot on the weekend. And when we question them, yeah, Friday night, they put some medicated stuff in the water. Saturday, the birds didn't drink. Sunday was a super hot day and they were all dehydrated and, you know, they have a mass die off. So for birds, generally providing shade, making sure they have, you know, easy access to water is usually going to be pretty good. There's still problems potentially, but they're pretty tolerant.
This is Pet Chat on 2NURFM, and we have Mel from Greenlands on the line. Hi, Mel.
How you going?
Good, thank you. You've got an issue with your pet dingo.
Yeah, we took her to the vet there a couple of months ago. She it mostly seems to be of a night time for some strange reason, but she'll wake up and like sort of a gurgling sound, and she's sort of trying to breathe. And the vets first thought that it could have been a infection of the trachea. Medication for that didn't make any difference. So then I suggested to the vet that maybe it was reflux, and medication for that didn't make any difference. So I've sort of been doing a bit of checking in that, and I'm sort of thinking that maybe it's coming, I'm fairly sure it's coming from the nasal passage, like through the nasal passage rather than the throat. And I'd wondered whether adenoids could be an issue.
Yeah, we don't really identify adenoids as being a common structure that we see in dogs causing problems. Sometimes in our brachycephalic dogs, we do pull sort of laryngeal saccules out of there. But we do see chronic nasal infections from time to time in dogs. And they can be fungal infections, so they can be a little bit nasty and tricky and sort of slow growing and simmering rather than like a real fast onset sort of thing. Usually we have to do things like, well, we would start diagnostically with taking a bit of blood work, looking for an inflammatory CBC, you know, whether or not we've got white cells that are elevated, things like that. Yeah. Head x-rays, though, a series of head x-rays for us to look at the nasal passages and see if we can see. We're often looking for changes in symmetry between the right side and the left side.
Well, I did do x-rays on the first visit, and they couldn't see anything there, and I did ask to revisit that x-ray and have another look.
And you might actually need a second set, because unfortunately we've got, often a 2 week to 3 week, sometimes lag between the bony changes that we can see. And so sometimes we will come back and go, listen, I can't see anything really dramatic here. But if we x-ray 3 to 4 weeks later, we can sometimes then see it. It is, x-ray is a bit of an insensitive tool for it. And the gold standard certainly would be a head CT, where they can pick up much, much smaller changes and smaller things. And I guess if it is persistent, that's what I would say is, you know, go back to your vet and sort of say, you know, should we revisit, do another set of x-rays. There are other things that can occasionally be done, like cultures of deep nasal swabs. The dog would still need to be under some really heavy sedation for that, because we've got to get the swab from, you know, far back in the nose. Sometimes we do flushes where we'll actually put a protective breathing tube down the throat, and then we can actually flush saline from the front end of the nose into the back, and you sort of catch it at the back of the nose and see what kind of muck and gunk you get that way. If it's persistent.
Yeah, even allergies or something like that. But
yeah, we don't see, we do see allergies in dogs lots, but we don't see it come out in their respiratory passages very much. It doesn't seem, you know, it's like hay fever syndrome seems to be a human disease. Allergic skin disease is how it presents in most dogs. If you're worried about it, I would, you know, take her back up to your vet and sort of say, can we revisit? Maybe we can do another set of x-rays or, you know, get a second opinion if you're...
Yeah, what was that disease you mentioned?
The disease? Hay fever? Like a fungal infection up in the nose or...
Yeah, I thought you mentioned something else early where they sometimes get some disease.
Aspergillosis?
What's that?
That's a fungal infection up in the nose.
Okay. Yeah.
Aspergillosis is a fungus that lives in a lot of eucalypt trees, so it can crop up in unusual places sometimes.
Yeah, just one other thing with it. She had a small growth removed from under her right eye there about a year or so ago.
Yep.
And because that's pretty close to the nasal passage, I'm wondering whether there's any scar tissue or something, or growth or something there that's caused an issue.
Only if they were actually digging down through bone to get the mass out.
Yeah.
Usually those sort of masses are just on the surface on the skin, and there's a good layer of bone there between that and the nasal passages. So it shouldn't be that.
Yeah, okay then.
Okay.
Okay, well, thanks for that, and we'll see how we go with another visit.
Good luck with it, Mal. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Bye. Next on the line, we have Deb from Beresfield. Hi, Deb. Thanks for holding. How can we help you?
Well, I have a almost 10-year-old Cavoodle, and he's got warts, and he's never had warts before.
Yep.
But he's had them now for about the last 12 months, and he's got three on top of his head.
Yep.
And one of them is very dominant, and he rolls around on the carpet and scratches the top of the wart and it bleeds.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
Is there something, and when I took him to the vet for his last lot of needles, I mentioned it to the vet, and she said it's only old man warts.
Yeah. So they, and that's what they are. I mean, we get some dogs who just seem to be prone to developing, you know, warts. They've obviously had contact with a papillomavirus at some point in their life, and they've it often doesn't happen till they're older, but they start breaking out in warts. And the dogs that are prone to them often will get many, many of them, you know, sometimes dozens. And they're not dangerous in terms of they're not a cancerous sort of lesion. But if you do have one or more than one where they're repeatedly being scratched and they're bleeding, they can lead to, you know, superficial infections, things like that. There's not a lot of good stuff we can do other than to cut them out. Depending on the size of them, sometimes we can use like cryosurgery, like we would put a little freezing on them. Usually by the time they're big enough that they're scabbing over and bleeding, the best course of action is to just have a quick minor procedure to take the worst ones off. And you wouldn't go through and take them all off, but, you know, any that are repeatedly bleeding. How's your Cavoodle's heart? Does he have an okay heart, or is he one of these?
Yeah, Now yeah. he's fine.
Yeah.
He does have Cushing's disease.
Yeah, that's okay. That shouldn't make him an unsuitable anesthetic candidate. So it's worthwhile okay. having a chat with your vet and saying, listen, I know they're benign, but this is becoming a problem. You know, he's bleeding all over the house and there's just a bit of a risk of infection. Minor, but, you know, it's still there. So have a chat with your vet and see if you can get some of those worst ones removed.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Deb.
Thank you very much. Bye. Next, we have Sue from Caves Beach. And Sue, you've got a Dachshund on medication for itchy skin. You're looking for an alternative.
Well, I've seen on social media, they're all saying that vets are recommending certain sprays to combat the itchy skin.
Mm.
And I know what you see on social media is not always right, you know.
Yeah.
But there was just so much of it on there, you know, and they're all bagging the Apoquel tablets.
Yep.
I know they're expensive, but they work.
Yeah, my dog takes Apoquel as well for her itchy skin. She's on a range of things. So welcome to the itchy skin club, Sue, because it's one of those. It's like a lifelong club when you have an itchy skin dog. Unfortunately, I mean, it obviously depends on what your dog's triggers are and you know what degree of diagnostics you've sort of been through. My dog is allergic to 38 of the things on the 70 allergen panel. So she's pretty severe. And you don't, unless you've had your dog tested for allergies, you won't know, you know, what's happening there, what things she's allergic to, he or she. There are lots of things that are on social media. Some of them are based in a little bit of science and some of them are based in nothing. You know, the various sprays. The only spray that I can think, there's two sprays that I can think of that I use. One of them is that when we have dogs who have chronic itchy skin, they often do get a bit of dry skin. And so we use a particular leave-in conditioner or sometimes something like, used to be Alpha Carry Oil, but I think they've gotten rid of that now and it's now... starts with a C. Anyway, like an in-water, a water immersible oil, like it's a bath oil. And we sometimes mix that up in a spray bottle and we will put a light dusting of that onto dogs that have chronic itchy skin once a day. Because if their skin gets dry, the barrier function of the skin is reduced. And so then more allergens get access into the deeper layers of the skin and that means that they're more itchy. And so we'll sometimes do that from a humidifying standpoint. The other spray that we use is something, it's a steroid spray, a HCA type spray. And we're using that as a treatment for localized, you know, inflammation. So when you get a dog that's got a particularly inflamed area of skin, this is a prescription drug that we can use, and we spray it once a day or sometimes once a week even to try to help settle down that particular area of the skin. And we use it in short treatments because even though it's a topical treatment, using it long term will actually make the skin thin out more. And so you've got to sort of walk that line. A lot of the stuff on social media, you know, they're talking about herbal this and herbal that. Anything that talks about tea tree oil, we want to avoid that because it's actually not very safe for dogs and can be more irritating. What I would do is if you are interested in trying something, you know, I would send an email or visit to your vet and say, hey, you know my dog's history. Is it okay if I try this? And most things aren't going to be detrimental, but there are a few things out there that, you know, are not very good for dogs. And because our industry, when it comes to things that are not pharmaceuticals, is totally unregulated, you know, I would always just say, ask your vet before you put it on your dog's skin.
I think that I will stick with the Apoquel tablet.
Yeah, listen, I mean, we want these dogs to be comfortable, and it's often multimodal therapy that we use. And for, you know, if it's working for her and she's comfortable, he or she is comfortable, stick with what your vet has prescribed would be my suggestion.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. You've answered my question.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Sue.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Okay, and thanks for holding, Janelle from Toronto. You've got a Siamese cat that has kidney disease and hypertension, won't take medication.
That's it. Hello. Oh. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome, Janelle. So, yeah, one of our lovely old cats that's got multiple things going on.
Yeah.
And what kind, are you using tablets or are they pills or liquids or compounded or...
So what they are is, well, first of all, had to be put on, what is it called, Depro, Medrol. He's been on that now for about 11 months because he was getting respiratory type stuff. So they did, they did investigations and he had inflammation in his lungs. Mm-hmm. So he's been on that now for about 11 months. And prior to that, I have two cats and they're both 15.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they're both on Solensia, 7 milligrams each month for their arthritis, mm-hmm. which is great. And when Floyd had a full blood test 3 weeks ago, and it's come back that he has kidney disease.
Yep.
And I just said to them, look, can you check his blood pressure? Because I listen to you guys a lot.
Yep.
And anyway, so they tested his blood, and he does have blood pressure.
Yep.
It was 180.
Yep.
So now they've given me medication that I went and picked up yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the packet? Emadol, is it?
Yep.
Tablets,
yep.
Which they said break it in half and see how you go.
Yep.
I put it in the food last night and he didn't eat it.
He's
then
not
this
eating.
This morning I've put it in his mouth and I don't know if he's taken it or he's spat it out.
Okay. So tableting cats is a bit tricky. Depending on how tolerant and frail your cat is, you know, tableting cats, I always tell people, I usually give a demonstration, but if you can get a good, strong, firm grip over the back of the head and tip their nose up so it's pointing directly up to the ceiling, that usually means that the back or the bottom jaw, goes slack. And then you can often just sort of pop the tablet right to the back of the throat and just give it a little poke down, either with your finger or with a little pill popper. And although that seems like you're sort of bullying the cat into it, it's very quick. Once you get skilled with it, it's very quick and it's over in a flash. And they just tend to tolerate it pretty well. We do have some cats, if they're super food motivated, sometimes you can give them like a little sachet, not the sachet, but you know, the little straws of really yummy, you know, we call it kitty crack, but there's creamy treats and things like that. And some cats will take the tablets if they're sort of wrapped in that stuff, or if you sort of are getting them to lick that off, they'll sort of take it like it's like they get so fascinated by taking that creamy treat stuff that they'll just take the tablet down without noticing it, as in their desperation to get to the creamy treats. But not all cats will do that.
Yeah, he's quite thin. He's lost a lot of weight. So
yeah,
he's fragile.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know, and I think to myself, they probably should have checked his blood pressure. It was only that I asked them to check it.
Yeah.
And I actually rang my pharmacist who they do compounding for animals,
yep,
as well, and he said that because he's on the it's like prednisone, right?
Yep.
That could have inflated his blood pressure as well.
Okay. Yeah. The depramedrol. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, a 15-year-old cat with kidney disease, a lot of those would have hypertension. It would be typical. So, I mean, the other thing is, if they do compounding, they may be able to compound your the hypertension medication into a liquid that you can squirt in the mouth, and that can be a lot easier for some cats. We are moving a lot of our cat patients onto liquid medications because it does seem to be easier.
Yeah.
Even if you can't get the whole dose in, you can often get 3/4 of the dose in, and something's got to be better than nothing. So persist with it a little bit. I wouldn't expect cats to eat the treat. Like, they're not very good at just eating their tablets, even if they're chewable. So you probably are going to have to get it into him. Persist with it if you can a little while. Always, if you can, you know, reward him with a good treat that he likes afterwards. But if it's not working, then, you know, chat with your vet and see what else you can do in terms of compounding.
You know, food is a challenge too. You know, I've got to stand there and wait while he eats. Then he goes away. Then I bring him back. Then he eats a bit more.
Mm.
You know, it's challenging.
Yeah.
And you know, and he's at a fragile stage. But then he has good days and all that. But you know, he's got to get this medication in somehow.
Yeah. Yep.
And I don't want him, every time he sees me, that he thinks, oh, she's going to shove a pill down my throat.
That's right. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
I'm the trust person in our family with him, and I don't want him to feel that he's being bullied into having to have this medication.
Sure.
So, yeah, I thought I'd ring in and ask your opinion.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, if you get skilled at it, it can happen really quickly, and then they don't tend to hold too much of a grudge. But, yeah, persist a little bit and then have a chat with your vet and see if there's a different formulation that might work better for you if you're not successful.
Thanks for your call, Janelle. We really appreciate it, and good luck. This is Pet Chat on 2NURFM, and we're going to check out Pets of the Week, and we've got Penny and Ellie. We're going to start with Penny. She's a beautiful three-year-old cat.
Yes, she's a lovely tabby cat with, looks like she's got medium to long hair. She's a super sweet girl, loves attention, loves to get pats and hair and to be brushed. She is easygoing, has not shown any sassy behavior. They said that she would like a quiet home. She hasn't had a chance to meet any kids yet, but with her personality, they think that she would be fine with kids that respected her space. She has been in a home with some other kittens, and she was fine with them, and hasn't had an opportunity to meet any dogs yet. So medium length coat, lovely cat, and nice young cat. So if you are looking for a nice cat, think about Ellie.
Penny.
Penny.
We're going to Ellie.
Now Ellie. Ellie is our dog of the week, and she's a one-year-old boxer Staffy Cross. Says she's a goofy dog, loves to snuggle. She's always up for a play, loves nothing more than a long walk and sunbathing in the garden. She is a little bit of, needing still a bit of training, but she sleeps well through the night in her bed. They do say that she would like to come up into your bed or onto a sofa if you're happy to have her there. She's super food motivated and eager to please, so that's going to be helpful for training. Is fully housebroken. She'll sit, stay, lie down, and is waiting to show her paw, but she loses focus when she's outside, which probably means that her recall isn't very great. Ideally, she'd be suited to a couple or a single person with the ability to handle a strong dog. So probably not going to get this as a dog for grandma. would be suitable for a home with a family who already have a large, energetic dog, but not suitable for small dogs, cats, or other small animals. As she might be a bit overwhelming for them. She would be okay with kids over 12 and will require a minimum of a 30-minute walk a day and 6-foot-high fences, as she's pretty inquisitive. So if you're looking for a nice, young, energetic dog for a family, a busy family, not busy, but a boisterous family, then Ellie might be the one looking for a home, and she might fit with you.
Yeah, well, you can check them out on 2NURFM.com.au when you head to our lifestyle tab and go to Pet Chat, and then check out Pet of the Week or Pets of the Week. Mm-hmm. And we've got a little bit of time left. Just quickly, with it being so hot, you know, do people need to test the ground before they take their pets out for a walk?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was at the beach on the weekend, and I was saying that my husband blistered his feet because he refused to wear his thongs between the car park and the ocean when he went for a surf. And this happens all the times with dogs as well. And dogs aren't really good at showing you that their feet are sore. We often find people will come to us and they say, we went to the beach and then we came home, and later on that evening we realized that the dog's feet were all blistered and the pads were peeled off. And the ground and the sand both get really, really scorching hot, and your dog may not show any signs of pain, but later on that night or later on in the day, the feet will blister, the pads will slough off, and it can take days and days, weeks really, for that to heal. So absolutely, you know, take your dog out early in the day or late once it's nice and cool. Keep some water on their feet so that they, you know, things stay cool.
Good advice. Mm-hmm. Very good advice, especially with the heat at the moment.
Absolutely. So, yep.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Dr. Kimberly Earle. And that's the end of Pet Chat, 2NURFM.